Hello and welcome to the Weird Things Podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by my partner in podcasting, the only one that's ever mattered, Mr. Brian Brushwood.
Well, hello, and it's easier than ever for reasons that we'll discuss later.
Oh, yeah, we'll talk about that. You mentioned a while back that wanting to maybe see a Starship launch.
Yeah, I was hoping I would just catch one, you know, just on the horizon. I was always jealous of my brother, the time that John Glenn took his second trip into space on a space shuttle. We were both on the phone and he's like, I'm like, oh my God, history is happening. He's like, yeah, let me go watch it. And he walks out to his balcony and he's like, there it is.
So the next Starship launch is planning for March 14th.
Ooh, that's ill tidings.
Why do you say that?
Isn't that the Ides of March?
Oh, it's Pi Day.
I guess it is that. Maybe is it the 13th of March? I don't know.
So they've... basically, they plan to do a launch on March 14th with an attempt at trying to reach orbit.
Man, it's really interesting to watch them kind of indifferently iterate. And as people want to call, you know, this explosion after that explosion a failure, for them to explain... it's almost like a marketing move, except they're not spending any money. They're just patiently explaining, no, this is what it looks like to create a thing, is you have to have a lot of failures first.
Yeah, there was something that came out. I forgot what it was. And it was like this critique of like, oh, well, this is why you can't trust SpaceX, though. Look at all these explosions. And you know, like, this is why the government method is more reliable. It's like, okay,
oh, man, well. Somebody hasn't seen the right stuff where they have that beautiful just collage of explosions.
Well, and there's the whole, you know, shuttle launched 134 times. Two out of those blew up.
Well, if we're gonna make it sad, then also we'll talk about the first three lost souls where they got burned alive in the Apollo mission, Apollo 1.
Yeah. So, yeah, the point is to say is that, like, you know, the SpaceX method is test the heck out of these things. You know, don't you can either say, well, we're gonna figure out everything right in the blueprint phase and just know that it's gonna work when we go do it, which we clearly saw was not the case with the shuttle. Like the shuttle's anticipated rate of failure, which nobody likes to talk about, was way, way, way lower than what it was.
You know, it was bonkers. I recently listened to the Freakonomics podcast where they were talking about Dr. Richard Feynman and with the astounding hypothesis to my ears, not many people know about Dr. Feynman. And I was like, wow. But one of the things that he found notable was that their expected failure was like one in over 100,000 launches there would be a problem with. And it's like, no.
And it's an example of the system, the idealized version of the system versus the system in reality, right? And the idealized version of the system, it's like, well, you know, it's some solid rocket boosters, these, you know, three primary engines. It's a pretty simple, straightforward thing. But it's like, well, what was the problem? The fail cases. Well, one was the solid rocket boosters, because of pork barrel politics or whatever, you couldn't build them in one solid unit. They had to be shipped in cylinders that could fit on a railroad, which means now we got these.
And then on top of that, you had to attach them with what turned out to be a flawed, flexible material, the notorious O-ring that was temperature sensitive.
Yeah, it wasn't there in the original design, but then that was a necessity, a dot, dot, dot later on. Well, how will this affect the fit? Shouldn't. Then you had, you know, what's going to be the impact of, you know, hey, it just goes from launch pad to space. Well, you leave it on the launch pad, there's moisture, you get ice that accumulates, and some of that ice breaks off and it hits a wing. What happens? And that was not a thing they anticipated. And, you know, one of the things after the first launch, they came back, they looked at the windshield and they saw micrometeorite fractures and they're like, oh shoot, there's impacts here. Like, this is bad. That could cause a fundamental problem because as it's orbiting, it could hit something. So that's why the shuttle flew backwards, because they figured the main engines could handle it, because they don't use those engines, you know, other than a deorbit burn. I don't even know if they use the primers on that, but basically.
Well, and for those unfamiliar, yes, the space shuttle flew up, but it didn't fly down. It just coasted down. And that was based on the integrity of the, heat shield that it had. And then once it coasted down, like, there was no, like, if they had a problem, they couldn't just like go back to space. Like, that was it. You were going to glide down.
Yeah. Cause it had to do a deorbit burn, which was to decelerate. So it would lose its, you know, orbital velocity, but yeah. And it was, you know, it is an amazing achievement, and it, you know, all the more for all the hoops they had to jump through to do that. I was talking to a friend yesterday who's working with some NASA researchers on a project, and she's been going through just a ton of the archives of like all the old like NASA proposals and all the different stuff. And it's like, yeah, they were spinning out crazy ideas in the 60s, 70s, 80s, still to this day, but they were spinning out some really crazy, ambitious ideas. And that was one of the things that was frustrating for some people when they watched SpaceX, the reusable rockets, is, you know, there are scientists and engineers who, you know, pitched that similar ideas back in the 70s, you know, said, hey, we could do this. This is, you know, would it have been as practical? Would it have been able to pull it off? I don't know. But and I'd say that's where SpaceX gets its credit. It's one thing to say, I have an idea. It's like, well, putting it into space is key. And they did that. But there's been a lot of crazy
and even parts that they gave up, like they're no longer trying to catch the fairing, right? They gave up on trying to save that, or did they just figure out that
it being a little bit
wet is fine?
Yeah, it was. That feels like kind of an Elon, like, well, you know, wanting to come up with this really fancy solution to win, because you're like, waterproofing is really hard. I'm like, I mean, maybe, you know, I get there's a light.
Tell that to boats.
Well, that's the ratio weight. The weight ratio is a thing. But yeah, but it is a thing. Like, maybe you really need to rethink that, because, yeah, it is a clever idea to have this complete system where they never touch water. But, you know, I think they realized the physics of trying to predict. They thought they were getting better, but just reached the upper limits of like just the dynamics of trying to predict that too hard.
Well, and this is totally kind of peripheral, but there is a value if what you're trying to do is attract people to your story. There is value to a novel set of systems on there. So even if, for example, like it was a bold move to have drones that go out with E&M Bank's names on them and, you know, things land on them and all that stuff. And maybe per the numbers, that might not have been profitable, but it was so novel that, like, how much free storytelling do you get out of that? And even trying to catch the fairings, whether it worked out or not, you know, it's sort of, it reminds me a little bit of the, Starman launch, where they needed to have some kind of payload to launch, might as well make it cool.
Yeah, I guess it comes down to at what point, if the goal was to minimize cost and now they just drag him out of the water, you know, at what point do you realize this was a way more complicated problem we have and our net gain really is never going to be building a fully reusable rocket? Yeah, there's a total net gain to that. But building a, let's catch it instead of letting it fall in the water. And, you know, how many tens of millions, hundreds of millions did they spend on that? Because they spent quite a lot. And it comes down to, you know, eventually they realized, yeah, let's just go the other way. So, and it's hard to know, you know, if you should keep pursuing it or not.
And meanwhile, every time you do it, I mean, not that I don't want to rely on the old trope that all publicity is good publicity, but certainly it made headlines every single time they tried. And then maybe they saw diminishing returns and they're all like, yeah, that's about all the free advertising that we need.
Well, and I don't know that it was good that it's if the headlines that you keep failing at a thing and then you give up a thing, I don't know if that's really it's they're better distracting. They're better stories that can be told there, I would say. Not that anybody cared or was really pivotal that they kept dropping that.
I would counter with, and who's to say where the line is, but there's a lot of stories of people who, including the canonical one, Thomas Edison, you know, who identified, 10,000 ways to not make a light bulb, allegedly, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, but that's a post hoc story, and that led to a light bulb. You know, we don't get the story of 3M. You know, Apple is not going to want to do the story on the $10 billion they wasted trying to build a self-driving car. Like, Apple has kept that story locked down and does not, that story will make its way, but Apple does not want that story told because they just don't look good. They just look incompetent.
Speaking of Apple stories, how still in love are you with your ski goggles?
I mean, love is a word that I don't think I used before. My stance is still the same. It's a great demo, but it is an extremely compromised form factor. It is a very cool thing to use, but when I first reviewed it, I don't know what I'm going to use it for day to day. I've talked with other people, including some pioneers in VR, and we've all had sort of the same feelings, which is physically it was a compromise. The rumor was the original idea was to take all of the everything, all of the processing power, all that stuff that you need there, which also requires the bigger battery, everything like that, all the processing power, et cetera. And, this is the actual, for audio listeners, the physical device is pretty small, but there's still a ton of weight in here as far as GPUs, everything else like that, et cetera, which then mean that they had to go ahead and they couldn't fit a battery on here too. But original plan was to just reduce it to just the visual elements and put all the processing and everything else they needed to do that couldn't be put on here and put it on a wireless device, put it in basically a desktop little cube or box or whatever and have that communicate. So then, you'd be reducing a lot of the weight here. Okay. And you probably could put the battery pack on there, smaller battery, et cetera. The story was Johnny Ive had a fit. Johnny Ive insisted it had to be a standalone device. So they pursued trying to make this a standalone device, but they realized to have the compute that they wanted to have to do all that was going to be extremely resource intensive. And so Ive had left Apple. And then, I think they got so far down that path of what's this device supposed to be. And they realized that they probably had a plan to put in a battery pack or something on there and realized they only got 20 minutes of battery life. They had to make the battery pack external. And at that point, well, guess what? I now have a second unit. I have a second device. And I think they made the wrong choice on that. I get the idea of the pure device is completely standalone. They did not deliver that. They delivered a thing that is heavy on the face. Everybody I've talked to has them, all says, yes, it feels heavy. They can't imagine themselves wearing this for very long. I think if you have a head like Charlie Brown, you'll probably be fine. Cause I've heard some like, oh, it's not heavy at all. And it's like, well, you can't discount other people's subjective experiences. So I think as an experience, I think they nailed a lot of things in there. But my other big crit was Apple did not build a unique Apple app for that shows you to justify spatial computing. There is no, they could have built my favorite thing that Google did back when they were experimenting with VR was Tilt Brush, this wonderful painting program.
Oh, yeah.
Probably 10 years old now. What would a 2024 version of that made by really capable designers and engineers be? They could have built a fantastic, super easy, fun thing. Cause in Tilt Brush, I could go create a scene from Dune and then add some little animations and then send it to my friends and share it, which would be cool. And now 2024, you could do way more sophisticated stuff and share those things with people without having to go too crazy. I mean, they could have built their version of Rec Room. There was a lot of low hanging fruit that literally, for the price of an Apple commercial, you could have worked a developer team and have built a great experience. They did not do that, which I'm personally worried about Apple. I think they have great teams working on different components. I think they have great people working GPUs, great people working on a lot of the image processing stuff, great teams. But when it comes in there trying to bring them all together to build a new device, this is what we get, a thing that's really unsupported as far as example applications do and a really good use case for what to do. And I'm nervous about Apple, to be honest with you.
Well, and every time they make an announcement that misses the mark and becomes a punchline is a heavy blow to the reputation, which, you know, heretofore has been by and large sterling.
Yeah, and it's not easy to, like, little things they do really well, like AirPods are great. I mean, my AirPods don't like to talk to my Apple TV, but that's an Android problem. But, you know, sometimes AirPods aggressively disconnect and reconnect, but by and large by themselves, it was a simple little thing to go into, and I think they really did a fantastic product here. I think that for, you know, a device like this, I think that, yes, there is a rule. Spatial computing is going to be a thing. To what extent it will be a thing, I don't know. But, man, they just failed to make, you know, you got your iPhone, you pull up Mobile Safari, and you realize, wow, it's the real web. That's amazing. You know, you pull out your iPad and you start working with a pencil and you start working on that scale and you go, oh yeah, this is what tablet computing should be like. You pull out your Apple Vision Pro, you go through a couple of demos, you're like, oh, this is what it's like to have multiple screens?
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm like, oh my gosh, it's like a simulation of what I've already experienced before.
Yeah, I play with it a little bit, but then I'll probably touch it in a week because I'm like, What am I going to go do? And like, they could have done things like read, like, one, the low hanging fruit would have been build a better like paint tilt brush type program, because you can share those things, because then that becomes a cool thing. Hey, Brian, put your headset on, go check out this thing I built. This is really fun, really cool. More, you know, other opportunities there. You know, what would video, you can shoot spatial video in there. What should a spatial video edit, like, what should just editing video in a spatial environment be like? And, you know, I've talked about like this before, like, you could, you know, we're used to putting things into a screen, like video editing right now, basically was an evolution. The first nonlinear video editor, remember what that was?
It was a Premiere, but I know that quite literally we're still working with simulacrums of actual film editing, where it's like, go up to this point, literally slice it, put these two parts together, et cetera, et cetera.
So it was a project called Edit Droid. Now, if anybody follows copyright history, may remember that Droid is a term that George Lucas had copyrighted. And this was built by a spinoff from Lucasfilm called Droid Works.
So if I search for Edit Droid on YouTube,
one word edit droid in Wikipedia, you'll get it. So what happened was Edit Droid, and then they came up with, there was a version called Diva, which was like a nonlinear editing system or whatever, which was bought by, or Avid bought it and developed it. So Avid became Avid Editing Systems.
Oh, of course.
The IP from Lucasfilm. So that's where it came from. George Lucas, his team came up with the first edit, nonlinear based editing system.
Avid used to be very, very complicated. Premiere made it very simple and approachable. But there's a 40-minute documentary called Edit Droid, The Rise and Fall.
Oh my God, I gotta find that.
On YouTube.
What they did, which was brilliant, was, remember back then, you don't have, you know, this thing was made, when did they make this thing? Like, this is like mid-1980s. Like, you didn't have like RAM or anything to do that. So they used laser discs. And so it was a bunch of laser discs going back and forth to allow you to do the system. I mean, just a really, really clever, you know, the idea that you one day you would have enough RAM to hold an entire, you know, film, whatever, was just a crazy idea.
But that was nonsense.
So saving that to watch later.
Yeah.
So anyhow, I digress. The point is that, you know, as you talked about, like, you know, we went from, you know, my first job as a teenager, worked at a movie theater. I had to assemble films and I had to sit down at the little bench with the little magnifier thing to look at the frames, make sure I match that stuff and tape them. And then I had to break them down and do that. But anyhow, the point is, like, yeah, there could have been a really cool, like, I don't know, maybe I sit in a room where I have all my film clips hanging like pieces of film. Maybe that's not the way to do it. I don't know. But like, man, it would have been cool to really experiment with what a spatial computing thing could be, instead of literally it's like, here's your iPad screen. Now here's your iPad screen and your Apple Vision Pro. It's like, cool.
That's actually one of the things that I wanted to do, and probably it's upcoming on the Modern Rogue, is actually shoot something in 8mm and record separately using a tape recorder and do the ADR and the Foley work and the manual editing and run it on an actual projector to like who actually assembles short films that way anymore?
Yeah, there's plenty of gear out there though. So I mean, the way you do it now is you just take your footage and you do a transfer. So then you edit it and you get your time codes and then you can go back and then have your film put back to spec on. Because that was originally what electronic film editing was. And even for tape editing was, you would do a very, very low res version and store that. And that's like how your video toaster work, like video toaster for editing, is you would store a super low res version of that, edit that, get your time codes and go back and run the tapes back and forth and record out.
Well, and that still exists in the form of proxies, right? Where it's like you'll not actually render everything that you're working with, but you'll have proxies that and then that, and then the other thing, and then you hit the render button and then you go get a cup of coffee.
Yeah, exactly. And that came from the day of you'd have what they call the work print. The work print was that the copy of the film was a bit more rugged of them. And here's something, we found a work print for this. That was one a little bit like a thicker celluloid stock, whatever, that could handle that. You would figure out your edits on the work print, you know, and then send your sheets off to like do the fine print.
I don't want to get too far into the weeds. Maybe now's a good time for us to remind people that they can support the show by going to patreon.com/weirdthings. Keep us loud, live, and independent. Get exclusive access to the After Things portion of the podcast. And most importantly, be cool.
I think I had a dream last night that I had to do the podcast by myself, and I remember to do the commercial break. I have this hazy memory coming back to me of doing that, of like, because now it triggers like, yeah, and like, think, speaking of people, you know what's really important is people make this podcast work. That's why you should support Weird Things. Yeah,
that's amazing.
So who knows where the future is going to go? Who knows what's going to happen up next? Things are just moving so quickly, and it is absolutely cool to see what's happening.
It sounds like you have something.
Oh, I got a story, Brian.
Okay.
I got a story.
All right.
Unless you got a story. I mean, I can pause.
Oh, I mean, we can always default back to AI talk. That's always on the menu.
Let me just do a detour into biotech talk, and then we'll go back to AI talk.
All right.
Okay. So biotalk. Colossal Biosciences, which is the company that bills himself as the first de-extinction company, says they have created stem cells they think will basically accelerate their effort to resurrect the woolly mammoth. And basically, they said that they've been able to create stem cells. You know, I think they're using mammoth DNA, and they're very optimistic that they're going to be able to make the next big step.
Before anybody gets upset, like I think all of us know that it's not going to be actually a perfect replica of the woolly mammoth, but I assume it's going to be close enough. It's going to
They're working from woolly mammoth DNA, right? And the idea is, if you can get a viable embryo, plant an elephant, and you should probably end up with, you know, there are things that come about, like not everything that determines your final shape or form is entirely in the genetics. You know, we've talked about that before. There's things called, there's things called like surface myelination. There are proteins that attach themselves to DNA. The effect between the mother's body and the embryo, she can pass on certain things, you know, gut biota, things like that, perhaps, whatever. So anyhow, but it would be, you know, it's not like they're going to be, you know, Jurassic Park in this with, like, you know, putting in, you know, frog DNA and stuff.
Well, although it The first time I heard about this, I want to say it was 10 to 14 years ago, where they were talking about, like, there's certain aspects of a healthy North American biome that require a megafauna, and North America were one of the ones that hunted them all away. And the idea was to, let's get something close enough to the woolly mammoth. Let's get some DNA. And I think at the time they were comparing it to cloning of Dolly the sheep. And let's get them in embryos. Let's have them gestate within elephants. And then over generations, get them more and more woolly mammoth-like. And then just let them go. Do whatever megafauna needs to do in the environment. Do you remember that?
Yeah, let me read you the AI summarization of this. The article discusses a breakthrough by Colossal Biosciences, a company aiming to resurrect the woolly mammoth. The company has created induced pluripotent stem cells from elephant cells. I got that wrong. They weren't using woolly mammoth, which can be programmed to develop into any type of cell. This is a significant step towards their goal of producing proxy mammoths, which would be Asian elephants genetically engineered to resemble woolly mammoths, which you talked about, Brian. While the proxy species wouldn't be an exact copy of the extinct animal, Colossal believes that releasing these animals to Siberia could help restore the ancient mammoth steppe ecosystem and combat climate change by slowing permafrost melting. However, the article notes that there are ethical concerns surrounding the use of endangered elephants as surrogates and that artificial wombs may be necessary. Despite the progress made with iPSCs, the article insists there are still significant technological and ethical hurdles to overcome. So they're trying to do exactly what you said. I was wrong. They are trying to Jurassic Park this stuff. And you want a woolly mammoth? Let's just take a elephant DNA and add in the Rogaine DNA.
Well, really, they're trying to buffalo it or bison it, basically, where it's like, you know, there's this unoccupied niche that needs to be that we assume ought to be filled for North America.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a cool idea. I'm all for it. Let's try it. Let's see what happens. Let's see what happens if we put them into an ecosystem that's not really, you know, that could use a bunch of large mammals stomping around.
We'll call it the Crichton test. Does nature find a way?
Well, let's go hypothetical. Okay. Let's say they find that because they're going for Asian elephants, I believe, because genetically that's the closest, you know, relative to it. But you go use Asian elephants and you get your baby pseudo mammoth. I don't know what the growth cycle is, but, you know, let's hypothesize that 25 years from now, we got a herd.
This is fun. At what point do we realize we've made a terrible mistake? At what point do we realize we have the equivalent of the feral pig problem in North America?
No, they are very easy to hunt, Brian.
Okay.
So easy that with sticks,
all of humans were able to eliminate them.
Yeah. We handled it. Did it once, do it again. But I think more the idea of that, you know, that's going to be all of a sudden there's going to be nature documentaries, things like that. It's going to be an interesting thing because now we're going to want to study, you know, what are these, you know, how do these creatures interact with and whatnot? What are they like? What behaviors do we see? How different are they? You know, how different are they from Asian elephants? What happens? Because also they're going to be in a further north than they have been. I mean, during an interglacial. Yeah, the colder part of interglacial. So I don't know. I mean, I think it'd be fascinating.
If anybody read the book, the follow-up to Jurassic Park, The Lost World, was a meditation where Michael Crichton focused on the idea of, okay, so genetically they're identical to the originals, but how much does, you know, a mother teaching a kid perpetuate over time? But like, there's one scene where like velociraptors are like, they don't even know how to do anything. Like moms are attacking kids or whatever, which strikes me as very Michael Crichton-y. But, that would be interesting to wonder if, if the behaviors even matter, given the genetics and the, you know, the passing on of memes.
How do you mean?
Take a look at humans. There's a fair spread of humans who are all genetically give or take identical, but different humans get taught different things over time. So imagine all of humanity just stops for a few minutes / eons, and then humanity starts again. Like, is there value in studying these new humans and interpreting their behaviors and mapping them onto what you assume old humans did, or is it the case where you know, all of our myths, legends, and behaviors actually matter? You know, are practical things. Everything from personal hygiene to go ahead.
Let me put it to almost like a nature versus nurture.
Right. Okay. So the question again is like, how valuable is it to watch? And
well,
the answer is how much. Yeah.
If it's one of these things, if we assume we're going to see what we expect, one, it can be slightly confirming, you know, that. But if we see things we don't expect, and I wouldn't surprise me if we might find there might be some behaviors that are different, you know, and comparing, you know, I think woolly mammoths and Asian elephants are going to be much more closely alike than, let's say, killer whales and, you know, forms of like, you know, other dolphins or whatever. But, you know, killer whales, you know, how are they? Well, they tend to be in these sort of matriarchal groups, you know, the mother and her offspring and whatnot. And that's interesting. Do we see, and that's hardwired, you know, and so we would see this, like, depending on how much, you know, are they able to use woolly? I don't know if they're going to use any woolly mammoth DNA at all, or if they're just going to try to like backwards work their way to a thing. But even the idea of being in a thing with a harsher winter cycle than any elephant species deals with right now, does that change things? You know, is the, you know, are you going, who's going to be the alpha there? Is it going to be the one that prepares for that cycle, the ones that's able to fatten up and stay stronger through there? Like, you might see things just literally by just a temperature differential might elicit behaviors we didn't expect.
Okay. Well, then let me walk back my, like, I'm not going to say that there's no value in observing, but in terms of one-to-one correlation, whatever it is we get will be its thing, and we can maybe intuit, you know, kind of default desires or motivations, but that's about it.
Maybe. I mean, there can be, again, think about it this way, is like, one, you're putting into a different environment than elephants that exist currently, right? Does the morphology alone make a big difference? Does, you know, and also the difference we're going to put too, is we're going to put in an environment where it's still, well, we'll see, like, will wolves start to, you know, start to hunt them? Will wolves start to do that? You know, like, what will happen? And so I think that you might see things, emergent behaviors that explain things we didn't understand before. Remember, if you said putting, you know, figuring out part of the cladogram to put dinosaurs or put theropods or put like, you know, T-Rex and stuff like that. Is it a bird? Not a bird. Once you understood bird, you really, things started to make sense. You started to understand things a little bit better. You know, two is the complexity that birds, you know, bird species can be extremely complex with a wide range of behavior. And so I'd say that, you know, it could give us some insight too, to like, you know, what is it, you know, what does have like large, you know, having, you know, ginormous, you know, herbivores like that walking across a tundra, you know, what happens?
So if you're in Vegas and you're going to place a bet, either in number of years or yes, no, like, does Colossal actually deliver us, you know, something that looks like a woolly mammoth?
Do we get a hairy elephant in 20 years? Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Is it genetically identical to, no? Yeah.
Well, so here's the thing, is that in genetics, one of the things that we're starting to be able to get into is the ability to create hybrid DNA. Like we can do programmable DNA now. We can sit down at a computer, start adding sequences, do this, have a genetic sequence or produce that DNA strand. If we get to the point where we're successfully able to continuously put that inside of a sperm or inside of an ovum, and get them to link up, you know, or replace the genetic structure in just a recently fertilized thing. Yeah, I think it's going to be as close as you want to get it. And I told you that the kind of the really, I've mentioned this before, but I'll say it again. I'm not going to name names. I have a friend, a paleontologist, who's been involved in research where they have looked inside fossilized bones and found that certain structures are still there. And one of the things they found inside of there, when they would crack open a bone, open them inside there, and find these like tiny little weird balls of iron, which were sort of weird. And then when they start to dismantle them, they find what looks like what could be genetic sequences.
Oh.
65-million-year-old bones.
Oh, that's wild. So, like the iron filings, for lack of a better word, basically like wax,
well, not,
like wax not, models not, mushed up against those very sensitive.
More like what happens is that iron, the presence of iron in the presence of DNA may create a binding thing that prevents the DNA from decaying. So, I mean, this may be published research by now. So let me take a look. And let me look for this. So the key takeaway there is that we realized that with, yeah, there is. When you have, you might say like, yeah, but it's a bunch of little fragments and stuff. Like, yeah, but you know, museum shelves are filled with dino bones that may all potentially contain some trace fragments of DNA. And all I need is a bunch. You know, if I take two strands of DNA and break them up, they're not going to break, generally speaking, in the same places. They're going to break in different places, and I can use that with a computer to reassemble what the full sequence would look like.
Right.
This is evidence of proteins, chromosomes, and chemical markers of DNA and exceptionally preserved dinosaur cartilage. This was January 2020. One of the researchers was Mary Schweitzer, who's and my friend Jack Horner. So yeah, they published this. So they had a duck-billed dinosaur, which this is 2020, so this has been out there. So they found basically evidence of different forms of cellular preservation that extends far beyond what we consider, let's say, the half-life for DNA. You know, for those, you know, DNA half-life basically says that over a period of times, X thousands of number of years, DNA breaks down by half and by half, a half and half continues to the point that when you're trying to go back more than like a few hundred thousand years or something, there's not going to be anything left. But the problem is that assumes average conditions. We know that if I put DNA inside of a freezer, you know, it will last much longer. But you'd be like, oh, those conditions don't exist. Correct. But we've established there are other conditions. So it's not like half-life for radioactive decay where there's nothing I can do to prevent that decay. DNA half-life happens because of a chemical and, you know, entropic processes brought in by heat or other things. But the idea here is that, well, it might have things might bind with this stuff and then prevent that decay.
I'm going to pivot here real quick, but did you happen to read the articles that were boohooing on there's less oxygen in Europa than expected?
No, I didn't hear that. Thanks for the killjoy.
Yeah, sorry. Whoopsie doodle. but who knows?
Well, The question is, let's see, what is the I mean, there may be other factors and things that take place there too. Like one of the things here is like, why, you know, how did we get so much nice oxygen in our atmosphere?
I mean, the answer was we waited a long time to develop animals. We just had a lot of plants for a very long time.
Yeah. Yeah, algae. Oxygen is a pollutant. Oxygen, the oxygen we love and crave, was actually a, you know, byproduct of all this algae producing this, and they ruined the earth before we did. They ruined the earth with all this delicious oxygen.
Got
and it's one of these things that you no species has ever affected thing on a planetary scale. algae enters the chat.
Right.
The reason we're here right now.
I don't know that it changes our expectations too much as far as like, is it worthy to continue to explore and try to find life throughout the universe? However, that was a setback. Europa was a sweet, sweet target for a hot minute.
Yeah. And again, that we are, they're looking at hydrogen outgassing from the moon's surface. They estimate the amount of oxygen produced to be around 26 pounds every second. And let me look through here. They're looking at surface. And so we don't know what could be going on subsurface. We really don't know what's going on under that. Like, remember, there is a ice shield. There is then the whole subsurface ocean. And so as far as the oxygen production that could be happening, they're looking at like how much oxygen could be happening externally and then working its way internally. I'm going to give you like a kind of a crazy thing. So hydrogen production, right? Hydrogen. Where does hydrogen come from?
The Big Bang.
Okay. Where does the hydrogen that we have on Earth come from? Where does the free hydrogen,
Well, I know here on Earth, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that if we suddenly wanted to run on fuel cells, we would have to use electrolysis to break down water into hydrogen and oxygen. Otherwise, I know that hydrogen is problematic insofar as that it likes very much to float all the way to the edge of the atmosphere and then get blown away by the solar winds. Beyond that, I suspect that there's more you have to tell me.
What? So the conventional sort of theory was that we had X amount of hydrogen that was, obviously hydrogen bound up in water and CO2 and everything like that. Not CO2, but
and hydrocarbons are very, very solid.
Exactly. So there's forms of that there. And then that the hydrogen that we had was basically kind of what just sort of seeped up from the Earth's core or whatever out through there and whatnot. That any other hydrogen you wanted, you had to go crack something like a CHO2 or H2O or whatever to get that hydrogen out of it. Okay. So there was, in a lot of our understanding about the available resources, materials on our Earth is based upon certain amount of scientific exploration and a lot of like petrochemical exploration. And petrochemical exploration looks for specific things. You want to dig an oil well where you have a really high chance of digging an oil well. That's why fracking was such a big revolution, because fracking came up with this idea of getting things that were traditionally ignored. Like, yeah, there's stuff down there, but you can't get to it. Fracking's
you may remember this. I don't know if some of the listeners have ever heard, but like that's why when I was in second grade, my family moved to Colorado. Is we lived in Denver, Colorado, just outside of Littleton, because my dad was part of the exploratory team that was trying to figure out whether or not shale oil, whether the juice was worth the squeeze, because my dad got into petrochemicals in the late 70s at the height of, the OPEC, cartel restrictions and so on. And what they figured out was, yep, it's there, not profitable to do it. And then the revolutionary aspect of fracking happened. And fracking, for those of you guys who don't know, because you are releasing liquid natural gas, petroleum that can be made into liquid petroleum, there are so much less carbon in there. The American boom of made possible by fracking is, I believe, measurably the single biggest advancement in pushing back climate change. Like, I don't know if I'm overstating it when I say it that way.
Yeah, it is the goal of basically reducing the amount of carbon that we contribute through industrial processes and whatnot, is reducing the amount of C in whatever, the carbon and whatever you're breaking apart or doing that, and Methane, yes, has a carbon in there, but actually has more hydrogen. So the more hydrogen atoms that are inside of there, the higher the rate of energy you get from there. And that's a good thing. If you go back and look at like coal, it's like a carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. It's very small ratio, but methane, these things get better and better with more hydrogen. So that's kind of the goal. And hydrogen economy, get into the problem with that of like, it's just horrible to transport, whatever. It just really, I had almost a yelling match fight with somebody once over this. Was an engineer who was just all in on, you know, the hydrogen economy and everything like that. And this was like 4 years ago. And I'm like, it's like, you know, I got to break it down. I got to convert something into hydrogen. So I've already got the energy and I'm applying it to that to do that. Then I got to transport it. And I'm like, I'm not like a big believer that lithium ion is the future of everything. But I was just like, it just seemed like too many impractical things. And plus I drive my car home at night. I plug it in. Done, you know, but anyhow, so theory had been that kind of like basically that hydrogen, you know, that kind of be what was available, et cetera. In France, there was a location where they had extracted like some hydrogen for, they thought they'd kind of got all of it out, but then it continued to produce hydrogen. And that was, and it was, you know, basically like naturally occurring hydrogen just seeps up from the earth. And they're like, wait, why is this happening? And there's a couple of locations where I think they think they've observed this, where they're seeing hydrogen continuously come through ground sources. And the theory is, there's a theory that shows that there can be a geochemical process where basically, you know, you get a certain amount of pressure, certain kind of rock formation, certain amount of liquid there, and it just starts producing the hydrogen. And that basically that you might have a lot more naturally produced hydrogen in places we didn't realize. And that's when back to the whole thing of Europa, whatnot, like, yes, they're looking at surface availability of oxygen. There might be some processes or things like that that we're not aware of that could be producing oxygen at some other level.
Oh, man, there's so many threads that are very tempting to chase. I don't know. But also, we're far enough into the show that I feel like we need to not go all the way out into the universe.
Yeah. If anybody wants to Google it, the term is white hydrogen. White hydrogen stands for naturally occurring hydrogen.
And that would be something created here internally on Earth.
Yeah.
Which would be huge for fuel cells, but has yet to be found, confirmed, and
we have a number of processes we understand that create it. Like sources can be. One, the primary source is degassing, what we talked about before, just the hydrogen that's here from the formation of the Earth just sweeping its way up. But then they talk about the reaction of water with ultra basic rocks, serpentinization, which is another process where this can happen. We don't know the scale at which this happens. That might happen at a greater frequency than we realized. And we just haven't been looking for it so much.
I assume that's mainly because that's a highly speculative bet. But anyway,
just to clarify. Yeah, because if you didn't think it was there, you weren't going to invest the money in looking for it.
Right. Right. We got time to talk picks.
Sure.
What are you into?
I have a very fun YouTube channel, which let me pull up the name for, which I discovered completely by accident. And well, I mean, I discovered it completely by algorithm.
By on purposeness.
Do you like high energy physics, Brian? I know you do.
Who doesn't? Yeah. Woolly mammoths and high energy physics. Who doesn't love both of them?
I mean, let me rephrase it. Do you like things like some dude making a 20,000 volt plasma knife from Halo?
That always terrifies me, but I'll not deny that I respect the players.
Yeah. How about making a 120,000 volt ray gun? Does that sound cool to you? I
mean, that sounds like a 120,000 volt ray gun.
How about experimenting with one of my favorite theoretical ideas of the future, which is going to be ionic wings or ionic surfaces, for basically the idea of using electric ionic fields to move air across aerodynamic surfaces. So you could have airplanes completely no moving parts and really change the structure of that. Does that sound cool to you?
Oh, that sounds very cool.
Have you ever heard of a cold plasma torch?
Okay, now you're just making stuff up.
So here's the thing about plasma, which you may not realize. So you get plasmas when the electrons sort of flow free, whatever. If you get the electrons to flow really far away from the atoms, you're colder. So you can actually interact with the plasma and touch it and not feel like it's hurting you, because you're basically just touching a gas filled with a bunch of electrons. So one of the uses for this is you can actually do this by creating a high energy electrical field and pumping helium through it. And then the helium will, you know, they create a plasma state. Again, that's where the electrons flow free, you create like a needle, and you can get that to sort of extend beyond that needle point. And they're using that now to look at treating wounds, because you can actually use that to basically kill all the bacteria here. So I present to you the plasma channel.
It's a whole channel about plasma?
Yes. It's called the plasma channel, Brian.
Okay, go on. Continue to sell.
So he goes in and does a bunch of really cool things, experimenting with like high energy. He's a great explainer. He's building things like plasma turbines, which basically just have no moving parts but generate wind thrust. He did a trip to Helion, which is one of my favorite nuclear fusion companies, which is working on building a fusion reactor, which will basically have, you know, no moving parts, won't be steam powered, but will just go straight from fusion to energy, to electrical production, instead of like trying to, you know, steam, you know, which has been the answer for everything. He is a great explainer, highly recommend it, does some really cool demos and stuff. And you just start to appreciate, I think it's a great way if you want to learn about things like plasma and high energy physics, et cetera. Just a really fun channel. So that is, he builds a fuser, shows you his fuser, which, you know, as a fuser is, you can build your own fusion reactor. You're just going to be really hard to get, you know, net energy out of it. The fuser is one of the oldest ideas, and he shows it, you know, it's really neat stuff that he builds.
Right on. And so that is the plasma channel.
He does something too you might find kind of cool, is using high energy to control fire, to move fire around.
All right. You have my attention. I am 100% here for this. Have you seen the Dune Part 2 yet? Have we already talked about this?
Not yet. I have not seen it yet.
Then I will be relatively spoiler free, outside of to say that historically, every iteration of Dune I've experienced, and this is everything from reading the book to playing the CD-ROM game to the air quotes Alan Smithy directed version of it, I've loved all of them. However, my favorite part has always been the kind of Game of Thrones-y House Harkonnen versus House Atreides versus House Corno part of it. And after that, it gets what I previously had thought of as kind of hippy dippy, like, okay, now we're just crawling around Saudi Arabia, stealing oil, while the Catholic Church is leering over us. So I was very, very pleased with Dune Part 2, because it took what in general, the mystical parts of it that I never really dug, and made me really, really dig them. It's great. It's great. It's highly recommended. If you have the means, the Alamo Drafthouse put together a special menu, including a bunch of spiced popcorn. And I don't know what was in that popcorn, but it created this absolutely wonderful, surreal atmosphere, as you could smell it as other people ordered it. And then you ended up buying it, and then you ended up eating it. And it's like, oh man, this is a very trippy, placebo
kind of presence. I heard the worst part, though, is all the glowing blue eyes in the theater kind of really were distracting.
I mean, luckily, we asked them to take off their Apple VR devices.
Oh, the spice was causing the eye, the blue within blue.
Yeah. No, it was a real trip, man. I liked it quite a bit. It was way good.
I'm excited to see it. I am, you know, a huge, the closest theater to us is just one of those, like, you know, the screens got ripped. They don't care. There's another chain theater a little further away from us. That's just I don't want to wait to go for home to watch Dune, but a lot of time movies, I just wait for home because I'm like, yeah, I'm going to have a better experience at my house than, you know, going out to the movie theater. Cause they just don't take care of the, you know, the one near us, like, they literally have they're using an underpowered projection for the screen. So everything's like dim,
yeah,
you know, and the other one you go to, it's like one of those, this chain theaters. It's just like, oh, the screen's ripped. This is like, they just don't care. Cause like, yes, 70, 80% of people don't care, but often over time they just don't show up. You know, like I used to go see a movie a week.
It was a really, really magical experience because, it's been, a minute since I went to an Alamo Drafthouse, and they're back to caring very, very hard about stuff. Like, in my opinion, they got a little bit lazy on their pre-show materials, but this time they did just this incredible, you ain't never heard of Dune? Watch this 20-minute thing, and then like showing clips from every single iteration of Dune that ever was. And it's like, are you getting bored? Watch Christopher Walken perform Weapon of Choice by Fatboy Slim. And then it's like, wait, is it relevant that he happens to be the Emperor Shaddam the Fourth in this movie? Well, that's convenient. It was a great experience, man. It was really, really good.
Cool, man. I'm excited. I found, you know, it's just, I had a tremendous amount of nervousness and trepidation, you know, when this was coming out, and then it seems like everybody's very pleased with it. So, I said, my opinion, I enjoyed Dune first one, but I, you know, having read the books and getting to the middle of the book in that one, and it's like, and the story ends there. It's like, wait, what? And I'm like, well, how are you going to judge it? I'm going to judge it when I see part two.
This is my first time of experiencing anything beyond the first book, and we're trying to speak.
Well, spoiler. This is the first book.
Part three will be a little bit beyond the first book, I believe.
Part three is Dune Messiah. Part three is supposed to be Dune Messiah.
Exactly. Which I never read, and I don't know nothing about. So every version of Dune I've ever experienced has been, and that's the end. It was great. He was great.
You never watched the Sci-Fi Channel?
I did watch the Sci-Fi Channel one. Although I didn't love it. But
they did the sequel. They did Dune Messiah, Dune Children of Dune. They wrapped them together.
It must not have stuck in my mind. But my point is, from what I have heard, by way of our friend Justin Robert Young, there are more elements that I, for the first time, am going to experience if and when part three comes out.
Yeah. I think Villeneuve is like, he wants to do something else, then he'll go do that. And also, we have the series, the HBO series coming out.
There's an HBO Dune series coming out?
Yes, it was originally going to be Sisterhood of Dune, which was about the formation, like the early days of the Bene Gesserit, based on the Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson series.
Got it.
They changed it to now Dune Legacy because it's going to be, you know, more broader about that, the earlier stage, which I'm like, it's like the books takes place like right after the Butlerian Jihad. So it's this like, you know, once we got rid of the machines, how do this, but you've got anti-machine zealots and all this other stuff, the House Carino fighting against this, and the discovery that, hey, there's, you know, the spice stuff is pretty damn cool.
We can't go forever, but I always thought the Butlerian Jihad was so dumb, but then I realized, like, okay, Mr. Producer Man, how are you going to explain the importance of Mentats with computers? And it's like, oh, yeah, no, you got to make computers illegal so that you can have human computers and so on.
Awesome. Brian?
Yep.
It's been weird.